We already have a relationship with God. Everybody does. And let me preface this by just mentioning that whatever I'm going to share with you, this is actually based on an ancient tradition of knowledge from India. We call Hinduism nowadays. That's not the original name of that body of knowledge. It has other names like Vedic Dharma, Sanatan Dharma, but nowadays everybody calls it Hinduism or Hindu philosophy. And it's all based on the writings in the Sanskrit scriptures like the Vedas and the Upanishads and the Gita or Bhagavad Gita, the many other important scriptures like Puranas, Bhagavatam, Ramayana, Mahabharata. There are so many. But they're all intercoordinated, and it's a vast resource of knowledge on spiritual matters. So what does this tradition, what does this body of knowledge tell us about a soul's relationship with God? I explained to you that it uses a word, ansh. Ansh translates into English like a fraction of something. So it's not exactly correct, but we say every soul is a fraction of God. Which is partly correct and partly incorrect, because if you're a fraction of something, it means that without you, the whole is not whole. If you're 1/100th of something and you're kept apart, then there's only 99 out of 100 left. So sometimes people think, oh, well, if we're all a fraction of God, that must mean if you put all the souls together, that equals God. That's actually not what is described. The word ansh means that we belong to God, or we're substantially similar to God, put it that way, like a drop of water and the ocean. Both are of the same kind. So God is divine, and we, our soul, is also divine. So we have this substantial connection with God. That God is said to be in Sanskrit, Sat Chit Anand. It means eternally existing. That's Sat Chit. God is actually a personality, a being, somebody with a mind who can think and, you know, will and all of that. And Anand means true happiness or divine bliss. So that's one of the definitions of God in those Sanskrit scriptures, Sat Chit Anand. So we're a part of God. We're similar to God in our, you know, if you could analyze the soul, what is the soul made of? The same stuff God is made of. Whereas the world is not made of the same stuff. The world, see, this is not chit. This harmonium, the wood in it, doesn't have a mind of its own. When the tree was growing, it had life and it had consciousness and some amount of awareness, but that was only because there was a soul in that tree. Now that the soul has left that tree and the wood is being used, the actual wood itself doesn't have a mind. So it's not chit. This microphone is not chit. So only souls and God are alive, sentient, and aware. So we're similar to God, which means we're related to God. And also, just like our soul gives life to our body, God gives life to our soul. So that's why God is also called the soul of the souls. And all of that is represented by this one word, ansh, in Sanskrit, which means that, you know, we're part of God, God gives life to us, we belong to God, all of that. We're a power of God. So what I'm saying is, although the title of the series is Three Secrets to Creating an Intimate Relationship with God, in fact, that relationship already exists, both substantially, that we're related to God substantially, and also proximity-wise. Could you get any closer than God inhabiting your own soul? And also, dependency-wise. God is giving life to our soul. So just like our body is dependent on our soul, and that's why there's such an intimate relationship between the body and soul. Similarly, our soul's life is received from God. So that's a very, you know, intimate relationship already. Add to that that we are also said to be the children of God, not in a cliche kind of way, but in a literal way, actually, where that, you know, God is our divine mother, divine father, and we all, you know, God looks on us as you would look on your children. So that relationship already exists, but we don't experience it, or we don't experience it in its fullest, because we create an insulation in our own mind, or some kind of blockage that prevents us from experiencing this relationship. So the relationship is there, it's just about finding a way to experience it. So last week we talked about the first step, which is that many of us have a part of our thinking which is creating this blockage between us and God and not allowing us to experience our relationship with God. And that thinking is that either we blame God for certain things, or we mistrust God in certain ways. And I explained to you, you know, making it a little bit humorous, that if we could bring God to court and challenge him about certain things, there are a few points that almost universally people would like to ask God, why did you do this, or why is this like this? We covered a few of those points, like, if you're God and you're all-powerful, then why is there evil in the world? Why do bad things happen to good people? Why do good things happen to bad people? You know, why do people I love die? Why do I have to be separated from those that I love? And, you know, why am I here in the first place? So we have all of these doubts, actually, where we kind of mistrust that. Well, I know everybody says God is kind, God is perfect, God is good, loving, all of that. So if God is all of that, then why? How can the world exist in this state? We covered all of that in quite a bit of detail and understood how we can start trusting God, and instead of mistrusting, trusting, instead of blaming, thanking and being grateful, instead of feeling that we're being treated unjustly, actually just trusting and loving God. So just in brief, what we discussed was that the good and bad of the world exist eternally, and God never created that. I'm just giving you the gist, because we covered this in detail last week. So we can't, if we brought God to the court and accused him that you're God and you made this world, so why did you put bad in the world? Why did you put evil in the world? So God's lawyer would have answered that, no, God didn't create anything. God has existed forever, the souls have existed forever, and the world, not in this particular form, but the energy of the world. I gave you a word, Maya. That's the original energy of the world. That's existed forever. God never created himself, he never created any souls, and he never created that original energy of the universe. All three have existed forever. And that material energy that produces the universe, it already has good and bad qualities inherently existent. So it means that good and bad are eternally, they're eternal qualities of this material power. So when they've existed forever, you can't ask, where did they come from? You can't ask, why did you put them here? They've been here forever. So the why or how doesn't even, you can't even get to that point. Question number two we answered by understanding about the law of karma, that souls have existed forever. So we've lived unlimited lifetimes, and in all of those lifetimes we've performed good and bad actions, and we've now we're also undergoing the consequences of those actions. And those consequences come to us from past, or we're supposed to be, at least we're held responsible for our own thoughts, words, and actions. Yet there are things that happen to us also which are out of our control. So those things happen not because of good or bad luck, or because the universe is for us or against us, or because God is for us or against us, but because it's the outcome of our previous lives' actions. It's just like Newton's laws of physics. A action causes a reaction. So that's the law of karma. If we do a bad action, then sometime in our future, we'll receive some kind of unwanted consequence from that, some kind of hardship because of that. And if we do good things, we'll receive some kind of prosperity or happiness because of that. So again, we can't blame God. It's all on us. Whatever we do, we get the results. It doesn't matter that we can't remember. Some people say, well, that's like, punishing someone, 50 years after the fact for something he did when he was young. Why shouldn't he get the result right away? Well, the reason it doesn't work that way is because we're given the chance to, atone. If we do something wrong in this life, there's not an instant, slap on the hand or an instant punishment. We're given the whole rest of our life to realize I did that wrong thing, and then to spiritually atone for that. And then we won't receive any kind of hardship in the future for that. So it's all held over to the end of our life, so to give us a chance for that. That's one of the reasons. There are other reasons too. But so this is how it's all working. And the final question we had for God was, why did you put us here? And again, the answer comes, he didn't. We've been here forever, just like he's been here forever. The only thing is that we ourselves are separating ourselves from God through our own mental blockage. And that means that we're just living in this world without experiencing God, who is unlimited bliss. So we're bereft of that unlimited bliss that is our soul's desire, not because of God. You could say, God, you are bliss, so give me your bliss. What are you waiting for? But God has to give that in here, and if we're creating that blockage, then we're the problem, not God. So the secrets to developing our intimate relationship with God are all about what's going on in here. So the first step was learning to trust, learning to be grateful, and learning to love God instead of accusing or blaming God for things. One of the other things was people leaving who are close to us. So that's also part of the destiny. That when a soul is born in a certain body, it's already decided at their birth that they're granted this many years, months, weeks, days, hours, and minutes, and seconds of life. Right down to the second. I'm telling you just the way it's described in the Sanskrit scriptures. It's already pre-arranged the exact moment when this soul is going to leave that body and then go on and take another birth. Unless they became God-realized, then they don't need to do that. But that's a prearranged thing. So it's not like just part way along the way God decided, okay, you're attached to that person, taking that person away from you. It's not a random thing, and it's not about you. It's actually about that person. That person's time was up, and they're moving on. And the interesting thing is that we grieve for those who are gone, but those who are gone do not grieve for being gone. They go on, and they carry on from where they left off with their next life. And we, out of our attachment to them and lack of deep understanding of this fact, that they still exist, they've just moved on, we do grieve. But in fact, there's nothing to grieve for other than our own emotional attachment for them, which makes us miss them. So again, that's nothing to blame God for. And I also explained that the whole reason that this universe is here is actually to give those souls who haven't been able to experience God yet, to give them a chance to clear their mind of all of this and become surrendered to God and experience divine bliss. So, having understood this, the next step is actually meditation. This is, you know, part one was clearing some mental confusions, and then part two is to use meditation to really purify the mind and develop affinity for God. So before I start in with the meditation, does anyone have any quick questions about anything I reviewed from last week? Any holdover questions?
I have one.
Sure.
I just want to know, I guess, what's appropriate, a way to think. On one hand, I have like an image of myself and others of like being twisted and dirty and sinful. And then I have the image of being the divine. I have those two experiences. So,
which one is right? Is
they're that both are right, right?
Well,
like, what do I do with that? That's what I'm going
to. You know, our soul is divine, definitely, mm-hmm. and soul can't be tainted by anything, but we are bound also by our mind and body, because that's with the soul. And the mind does have the impressions or imprints of all of our past thoughts from this life and every past life, thoughts and actions. So you're right that, you know, we haven't only had good thoughts and actions, so we also have all of the bad thoughts, negative thoughts, wrong things we've done, all of that is stored up there. So there is an impurity to the mind, which is why the mind is difficult to control. That's why we have even now we have unwanted thoughts, because the machine that's producing the thoughts is of that kind. So it's going to produce more of those kind of thoughts. But on this path or in this philosophy, there's not guilt is not really a part of it. I mean, admitting a mistake is part of it, and feeling that, you know, accepting you've hurt someone else and feeling bad that someone else is feeling bad now, that is part of it. But then, you know, carrying guilt forward is not part of it. It's just like, you know, I did that, I shouldn't have done that, and now I resolve not to do it again. But I still realize that even though I've resolved not to do it again, because I am a faulty being, I probably will do it again. But I'll, by being conscious of this, I'll reduce the frequency. I'll become better. So nobody's perfect until God realization. So until then, we are faulty. But you don't carry guilt about it, you just accept it and try to improve. Yes?
And at what point are you God realized?
I'm going to save that for part of the meditation talk.
Okay.
It'll make more sense
okay.
once I've talked about meditation. Yes.
Maybe two different questions, so I don't answer if it is. But after last week, I've been thinking a lot about destiny, and like you were saying, our time, the clock is already there and it's already decided. And that I found myself constantly sort of at a crossroads. I'm also caring for my dog who's dying, and but you know, there's all these decisions to be made. So I'm always like, okay, God, help me with that decision. You know, it's like one decision could create one outcome, another decision could create another, and I'm trying to trust that the decision is there, but I'm still making it. So I'm confused at, you know, if I take one path, one outcome might come, and I take another might come. Does that make sense?
Yes.
I'm not sure exactly what my question is, but I'm confused.
I would say that don't worry about the outcome. Do the right thing. What comes, let it come. Just
right.
Do the right thing in every situation, as best as you can understand what the right thing is.
Okay.
And I sometimes, you know, as far as being aware of the limited time we have left, I tell people, you know, physically speaking, in the way you plan your physical life, plan as if you're going to live for 100 years, meaning, you know, retirement fund and all of that. You plan as if you're going to live for 100 years, but spiritually speaking, you live as if today's your last day, because it very well could be. But, you know, you can't plan physically like that, that, well, today's my last day, so who cares about my retirement fund? No, you have to plan physically for a long life. But spiritually, you should be in the frame of mind that this could be my last day, so how would I like to live it?
Claudia, I think if I heard you correctly, she was talking about her personal connection with her animal. A lot of people have that, and, you know, sometimes an animal gets sick, and, would, you know, I think this is, you know, whether to put the animal down or let it, you know, just die naturally. But can you talk, because the animals also have the soul.
I don't know what you're asking.
Well, my question is, I think that's the is that a part of it?
Yeah.
You know, like what to do, and you're saying do the right thing.
Well, that's a personal choice. I can advise on that. So now let's move to the next topic, which is meditation, and meditation is, although there are really dozens, probably hundreds of ways to meditate, there's really only two categories of meditation. There's intellectual meditation and there's affectional meditation. So normally nobody thinks of affectionately remembering someone or something as a form of meditation, but it is. Normally, when we think of meditation, we're thinking of these intellectual ways where, you know, maybe somebody's trying to think of nothing. That would be an intellectual meditation. Or they're, you know, concentrating on a candle flame. Or they're concentrating on their breath. There's different kinds. There's, you know, they're all variations of using the brain to focus on something and try to get some relaxation of the mind or some. Meditation techniques might be to develop a specific psychic power or yogic power. But in general, I would say nowadays in America, when people meditate, they're doing it because they want their mind to relax. They want to feel peaceful. And they do it through one technique or another, which all of those techniques are generally centered in the brain area, which is why they're called intellectual techniques. You're thinking about something. Now, affectional meditation is very natural because we do it all the time. If you love someone, you affectionately remember them. Is that meditation? Yes, because you're deeply remembering that person. And in fact, that has a joining effect. You become attached to the person that you affectionately remember, however many times you think of them and however deeply, you become more and more and more attached to them. And the other thing is that you start actually imbibing the qualities of the person that you're attached to. You think of the heart like wax. So when we affectionately remember someone, when we warmly remember someone, our heart melts. The wax softens. So when the wax has been melted, you can add some color into it that can't be added when the wax is hard. So it's kind of like that. When your heart melts for someone, then the qualities of that person enter your heart and become, it affects the quality of your own mind. We see that all the time, that we, you know, the people that we associate with, we adopt. Even just on a superficial level, we start talking like the people that we hang out with. We use the same phrases. We develop the same physical mannerisms. We're not conscious of it, but it happens. And then on a deeper level, we're actually adopting the qualities of the people that we're attached to. So this is a very deep and powerful form of meditation that every person does. Much of the day, because we're all attached to something. or someone, and we're always thinking about whoever we're attached to. So looking at these two types of meditation, one is actually natural. Affectional meditation, which is heart-centered, not brain-centered. You don't love someone from your brain. Your heart melts for them. So affectional meditation is very natural. We do it all the time. And intellectual meditation actually goes against the flow of the mind, because what we're trying to do is have the mind stop. That's what we really want. Just stop. You're thinking too much. You're thinking about all things I don't want to think about. Stop. I'm just generalizing about intellectual meditation. Through these various techniques, that's what we're trying to do. Stop the mind. But affectional meditation achieves the same result more naturally by thinking deeply about something. Not thinking about nothing, but engrossing your mind in loving remembrance of God actually quiets the mind. Quiets it of material thoughts, but you're still having devotional thoughts or divine thoughts. Material thoughts agitate the mind, but devotional thoughts, any thought we have about our relationship with God, because it's a deep truth, it calms the mind at its deepest level. So, affectionately, deeply remembering our relationship with God is called bhakti in Sanskrit. It's actually a path to God. So simple, right? How do you reach God? You deeply and affectionately remember God. That's the path. That's it. Nothing more. That's called the path of bhakti, which in English we could say divine love, devotion. And when you're sitting and meditating, we call it divine love meditation. So what are you doing? You're meditating on your relationship with God. That's it. So how do you do that? You can think of it in terms of your relationships in the world. What kind of relationships do we have? Brother to brother, brother to sister, son to father, son to mother, daughter to father, daughter to mother, best friends, mother to child, mother to son, mother to daughter, father to son, beloved to beloved. We have all of these different relationships in the world, and our heart likes all of these relationships. None of us wants just one of these relationships. We like all of it. We like to have a loving mother. We like to have a loving father. I'm saying best case scenario. Maybe you don't have that relationship. That particular spot isn't filled, maybe. I'm saying ideally, we would love to have that, and the friendship, and the beloved to beloved, and the child to parent. We like all of those relationships. They're all dear to our heart. And we have all of those relationships with God already. Divyo deva narayano mata pita bhrata suhrit gati. It's a verse from the Vedas saying that you have each of these relationships with God already. So the relationship is there, and the interesting thing is, in the world you need a separate mother, a separate father, separate child, separate friend, separate husband or wife. You need separate people to fill the desire we have for each of those relationships, but they're all bundled together with God. So when you're meditating on your relationship with God, you just choose one, whatever appeals to you most, and you just think that I have this relationship with God. You feel a close personal presence, like God is right here with you. And you feel that maybe you like the best friend idea. So you think of your best friend in the world, and then transfer those feelings to God. Think of your son or daughter and the love you have for them, and transfer those feelings to God. Think of your mother or father, and transfer those feelings to God. the positive ones, I'm saying, the best ones. Take the best case scenario and transfer those feelings to God. Take the feelings you have when you love someone as your beloved and transfer those feelings to God. That's the meditation. That's the whole thing. But when you do that, because like I was saying, whoever you affectionately remember in that way, you become attached to them and you start imbibing their qualities. So God is also everywhere. God is a divine personality who exists and who exists everywhere. And by thinking in that way, what's happening is our mind is becoming attached to God. And through that attachment, we start imbibing divine qualities into our personality. So what happens is it actually purifies our mind of all the other things stored in it that I mentioned before. The mind starts getting purified. That's one result. Another result is affinity develops for God. Affinity means real feelings of relationship when your heart melts. In the beginning, it's a little bit intellectual for us in that we have to think, okay, God is like my best friend, and then I'm thinking, okay, best friend. But eventually it becomes on a feeling level that when you think of God, you have those feelings, that affinity. It's naturally there in your heart. That affinity grows. And it's also felt as a joy and a contentment and a happiness due to that relationship, due to that connection you have with God. And that goes on increasing. The affinity goes on increasing. The happiness you experience when you meditate in this way, it goes on increasing. The heart goes on purifying, and then it culminates. When the heart is fully purified, then that blockage that keeps us from God, that's been removed. You can say in that moment we've become 100% surrendered, and in that moment God actually, you become God realized. You directly and fully experience God, whatever God is. There's what God is, you know, we can describe. Someone else who's experienced God can describe to us, but until we get that experience, we don't exactly know. So that direct experience comes in that moment when our heart has been fully purified. So that's how God realization happens. It's a gradual process of purifying the heart. This path that I call bhakti or divine love devotion, it's only to purify the heart and remove that blockage that we have within that keeps us from experiencing God or experiencing our relationship with God. And because God is unlimited bliss, once that blockage has been removed, or as it's removed, we start experiencing more and more of that bliss, and then we get the unlimited, ultimate bliss when we reach, you know, the actual end, when our heart is fully purified. So any questions about that? Yes?
When you talk about, like, in the beginning, like, choosing a relationship, my first question is it good to stick with one, or can you switch?
Change.
Okay. And the other thing I wanted to ask is, like, if you didn't have a good relationship with your mother, but you have a deep longing for that, can you use that, or is it going to be more...
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then, I'm just going to keep going, because I've been doing this meditation, and I think I'm experiencing, you know, what you're talking about, that heart-melting feeling and that kind of thing, but it has been intellectual for me, you know, to some degree as well, because I have to think these thoughts in order to get to that place still, and I'm kind of getting to a point now where my mind is wandering a little bit, and I'm not really sure, like... When you said, like, you get to a point where it isn't as intellectual anymore, it's just happening naturally in your heart, then what does your mind do then if you're not working to quiet it?
The mind is pulled into that.
Okay.
The intellect. The intellectual activity is quietened because your whole mind is engrossed in that loving remembrance.
I feel like my mind is maybe just getting bored with it right now, and I'm not really sure what to do with that. Like, I just keep doing it anyway, but...
there's a couple other things that you can add in.
Okay.
Because the relationship is good, but what we really want is to be related to someone definite.
Uh-huh.
Just saying you're related to God is kind of vague. We like to be related to somebody beautiful, that we can see their eyes, their smile, they have two arms, they can hug us, right? We want to form. Mm-hmm. So that's actually part of the meditation, that in this philosophy, God is described as having a form. And that doesn't limit God in every way. With that form, God is everywhere. And in fact, God has more than one form, but is omnipresent in all of those forms.
Okay.
So, imagining a form that you're loving is also part of the meditation.
Okay.
Sometimes in the beginning, that is too much for people because they're not used to thinking of God in that way.
Mm-hmm.
God is more of a general, vague thing to them. But actually, to take the next step in this meditation, you need a form.
Okay.
You have to imagine a personal form that you love.
But not a person that I actually know? Or can be if I know somebody who's...
Yeah, if you... See, you can think of any form you want as long as you imbue divine qualities, meaning that you're not literally meditating on that person. You're taking their form because you like how they look, and in your mind you're thinking, this is God.
Okay.
That's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Then you're actually attaching your mind to God, not to that person.
Okay. That makes sense.
Because... whatever is God's form, we can never exactly imagine it. Once we meet God face to face, we'll say, oh, that's what you look like. But until then, how can we imagine God's precise form? We can't. So any form is fine.
Okay. And that's, I guess, why it's beneficial to meet someone who is God-realized, because then you have that, and then you saw them in form.
Yeah. Like, sure, you can use that as well.
Okay.
Yeah. And, those God-realized saints have also described, because they have met God.
Right.
Saw, oh, that's what you look like. Then they described it in their writings that, you know, there are certain main forms of God, although God has unlimited forms, but there's like a divine love form and certain almighty forms. So the divine love form is the one that you can be the most free with in your relationship. You know, God also has a serious side. So... You know, if you're thinking of God as being supreme, almighty, ruler of the universe, there's a bit of fear there as well. But the divine, same God also has a loving side of his personality, you can say. And that divine love form of God is, you can meditate on and you can feel related to. And that form has been described by saints who have met God in that way. And... The form is a very loving, you know, beautiful form, which is depicted in this painting right here. That painting was done based on the description of some of these saints. So we, in our on this path, people also use you know, visual representations as a help in their meditation. It's not that, you know, we're saying that picture is God. We're saying use this image. Because saints say, you know, that's what God looks like. Of course, it's a material representation of a divine thing. So it's not
right,
exactly
right, yeah.
Right. But take that, because it's a beautiful form. So you can meditate. And saints describe the divine love form appears in two forms, actually. Female form and male form. So the names we've been chanting, Radhe Govinda, that's Radhe on the left. The female form of divine love, and Govinda or Krishna is the male form on the right. So that is, I would say, to get to the next level, eventually you have to start adding the form in. And you're not restricted to any particular form, but you can use the help of an image like this.
And you can switch?
Yes.
Eventually,
you'll probably settle on a particular form that you like the most and a particular relationship that you like the most. That'll happen, probably, but you don't have to force it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes?
Just a small question. Just thinking of my daughter, who's had very terrible relationships with many people, If you go to a cat and say you have a great relationship with a cat, is that a good place to start?
I never thought about that. I mean, I would probably take the parts of that relationship, like the cat is, you know, you can trust the cat not to hurt you. Yes, unconditional, you know, loving. You can take those qualities and try to transfer that. I never thought about. I'm not sure how that would work as far
it's
as.
It's unusual.
Yeah, but I think she understands and would be looking for those same qualities in a human relationship, mm-hmm. so she can transfer that to God as well. So now we added something more to the meditation. There's deeply thinking about your relationship with God. Then we added, you should feel that God is present here with you. That's really important. That you actually feel, if you're not a visual person, you should feel that God is present with you while you're meditating on your relationship. Then the third thing would be actually imagining a form, a loving, beautiful form that you want to love, that you want to even add the fourth thing. Now, interact. In your meditation, now you have a form. Now God can smile at you. You can smile at God. You can talk. You can hug, you can play a game, you can walk on the beach, you can do anything. So that interaction is called lila in the terms we use in Sanskrit. Lila means some kind of interaction between you and God. And then another thing you can add is like some kind of surroundings. You see, where are they sitting? You can think that's like the divine abode. You don't just have a form hanging in space, right? They're somewhere. In your meditation also, you can imagine that the beach you're walking on is a divine beach in the divine world, and you're walking with God, or you know, in a garden, or wherever you want to be. So that divine abode or divine atmosphere is also part of the meditation. And that's really all you need to know. You can add those things in to get greater depth to the meditation, but maybe in the beginning, just thinking of the relationship is enough. And then you get to a point where now I want to add the form in, and then now I want to have some interaction. So that's all up to you. There's no restrictions or rules. Just whatever deepens your feeling of relationship with God. Any questions before we put it into practice?
Sure. I don't know if it's going to be related to this point or not. And I asked you last time, how you can find your purpose in this life. Many people can find their purpose right away, and some people it takes time. And what could be the reason that's blocking you to get to that purpose?
There's two purposes. There's your purpose of your soul, which is to find God. And that's universal for everybody, and that's your real purpose. And then there's what you do along the way until you find God, which is physically what do you have to do to make a living. So, you know, people have different senses of purpose, meaning someone may just do it as a job because they have to do something to make a living, but their main focus is spiritual. And then other people who are not as spiritually oriented, they find more, you know, emotional involvement in the things they do in the world. That depends on the person. But the ultimate purpose is to find God. That's the same for everybody.
That means by meditation, and you get closer that you find God.
That's right. That's right. So let's do another chant. I forgot to add that part in, actually. The chanting is an aid in meditation, just like the picture is. The chanting helps the mind become engrossed by, for one, blocking out external distractions, and for two, it actually brings the mind in. And because these names that we're chanting are actually substantially related to the divine love form of God and the divine love power, the chanting does have a power. So your remembrance of God and of your relationship with God combines with the vibration of the chanting to develop the affinity in your heart more quickly than if you were to just do it in silence. You can do it in silence too, but the chanting actually can say it's like a catalyst. It speeds up the process and makes the meditation easier and gives you a deeper experience more quickly if you use the chanting along with it. So that's why we combine the two. The actual process that you're doing inside, your meditation, you think about that and just the chanting augments it or helps you to do it more easily. So let's close our eyes and you can put into practice what I was just explaining to you in whatever, you know, at whatever stage you are, but start with the feeling of relationship and then from there move on to, you know, feeling the divine presence of God and then moving to an actual visual. So now let's move to the next topic, which is meditation. And meditation is, although there are really dozens, probably hundreds of ways to meditate, there's really only two categories of meditation. There's intellectual meditation and there's affectional meditation. So normally, nobody thinks of affectionately remembering someone or something as a form of meditation, but it is. Normally, when we think of meditation, we're thinking of these intellectual ways where, you know, maybe somebody's trying to think of nothing. That would be an intellectual meditation. Or they're, you know, concentrating on a candle flame. Or they're concentrating on their breath. There's different kinds. There's, you know, they're all variations of using the brain to focus on something and try to get some relaxation of the mind. Or some meditation techniques might be to develop a specific psychic power or yogic power. But in general, I would say nowadays in America, when people meditate, they're doing it because they want their mind to relax. They want to feel peaceful. And they do it through one technique or another, which all of those techniques are generally centered in the brain area, which is why they're called intellectual techniques. You're thinking about something. Now, affectional meditation is very natural because we do it all the time. If you love someone, you affectionately remember them. Is that meditation? Yes, because you're deeply remembering that person. And in fact, that has a joining effect. You become attached to the person that you affectionately remember, however many times you think of them and however deeply, you become more and more and more attached to them. And the other thing is that you start actually imbibing the qualities of the person that you're attached to. You think of the heart like wax. So when we affectionately remember someone, when we warmly remember someone, our heart melts. The wax softens. So when the wax has been melted, you can add some color into it that can't be added when the wax is hard. So it's kind of like that. When your heart melts for someone, then the qualities of that person enter your heart and become, it affects the quality of your own mind. We see that all the time, that we, you know, the people that we associate with, we adopt, even just on a superficial level, we start talking like the people that we hang out with. We use the same phrases. We develop the same physical mannerisms. We're not conscious of it, but it happens. And then on a deeper level, we're actually adopting the qualities of the people that we're attached to. So this is a very deep and powerful form of meditation that every person does much of the day, because we're all attached to something or someone, and we're always thinking about whoever we're attached to. So looking at these two types of meditation, One is actually natural, affectional meditation, which is heart-centered, not brain-centered. You don't love someone from your brain. Your heart melts for them. So affectional meditation is very natural. We do it all the time. And intellectual meditation actually goes against the flow of the mind, because what we're trying to do is have the mind stop. That's what we really want. Just stop. You're thinking too much. You're thinking about all things I don't want to think about. Stop. I'm just generalizing about intellectual meditation. Through these various techniques, that's what we're trying to do. Stop the mind. But affectional meditation achieves the same result more naturally by thinking deeply about something. Not thinking about nothing, but engrossing your mind in loving remembrance of God actually quiets the mind. Quiets it of material thoughts, but you're still having devotional thoughts or divine thoughts. Material thoughts agitate the mind, but devotional thoughts, any thought we have about our relationship with God, because it's a deep truth, it calms the mind at its deepest level. So affectionately, deeply remembering our relationship with God is called bhakti in Sanskrit. It's actually a path to God. So simple, right? How do you reach God? You deeply and affectionately remember God. That's the path. That's it. Nothing more. That's called the path of bhakti, which in English we could say divine love, devotion. And when you're sitting and meditating, we call it divine love meditation. So what are you doing? You're meditating on your relationship with God. That's it. So how do you do that? You can think of it in terms of your relationships in the world. What kind of relationships do we have? Brother to brother, brother to sister, son to father, son to mother, daughter to father, daughter to mother, best friends, mother to child, mother to son, mother to daughter, father to son, beloved to beloved. We have all of these different relationships in the world, and our heart likes all of these relationships. None of us wants just one of these relationships. We like all of it. We like to have a loving mother. We like to have a loving father. I'm saying best case scenario. Maybe you don't have that relationship. That particular spot isn't filled, maybe. I'm saying ideally, we would love to have that, and the friendship, and the beloved to beloved, and the child to parent. We like all of those relationships. They're all dear to our heart. And we have all of those relationships with God already. Divyo deva narayano mata pita bhrata suhrit gati. It's a verse from the Vedas saying that you have each of these relationships with God already. So the relationship is there, and the interesting thing is, in the world you need a separate mother, a separate father, separate child, separate friend, separate husband or wife. You need separate people to fill the desire we have for each of those relationships, but they're all bundled together with God. So when you're meditating on your relationship with God, you just choose one, whatever appeals to you most. And you just think that I have this relationship with God. You feel a close personal presence, like God is right here with you. And you feel that maybe you like the best friend idea. So you think of your best friend in the world, and then transfer those feelings to God. Think of your son or daughter and the love you have for them, and transfer those feelings to God. Think of your mother or father, and transfer those feelings to God. The positive ones, I'm saying. The best ones. Take the best case scenario and transfer those feelings to God. take the feelings you have when you love someone as your beloved and transfer those feelings to God. That's the meditation. That's the whole thing. But when you do that, because like I was saying, whoever you affectionately remember in that way, you become attached to them and you start imbibing their qualities. So God is also everywhere. God is a divine personality who exists and who exists everywhere. And by thinking in that way, what's happening is our mind is becoming attached to God. And through that attachment, we start imbibing divine qualities into our personality. So what happens is it actually purifies our mind of all the other things stored in it that I mentioned before. The mind starts getting purified. That's one result. Another result is affinity develops for God. Affinity means real feelings of relationship when your heart melts. In the beginning, it's a little bit intellectual for us in that we have to think, okay, God is like my best friend, and then I'm thinking, okay, best friend. But eventually it becomes on a feeling level that when you think of God, you have those feelings, that affinity. It's naturally there in your heart. That affinity grows. And it's also felt as a joy and a contentment and a happiness due to that relationship, due to that connection you have with God. And that goes on increasing. The affinity goes on increasing. The happiness you experience when you meditate in this way, it goes on increasing. The heart goes on purifying, and then it culminates. When the heart is fully purified, then that blockage that keeps us from God, that's been removed. You can say in that moment, we've become 100% surrendered. And in that moment, God actually, you become God realized. You directly and fully experience God, whatever God is. There's what God is. You know, we can describe, someone else who's experienced God can describe to us, but until we get that experience, we don't exactly know. So that direct experience comes in that moment when our heart has been fully purified. So that's how God realization happens. It's a gradual process of purifying the heart. This path that I call bhakti or divine love devotion, it's only to purify the heart and remove that blockage that we have within that keeps us from experiencing God or experiencing our relationship with God. And because God is unlimited bliss, once that blockage has been removed, or as it's removed, we start experiencing more and more of that bliss, and then we get the unlimited, ultimate bliss when we reach, you know, the actual end, when our heart is fully purified. Any questions about that? Yes.
When you talk about, like, in the beginning, like, choosing a relationship, my first question is it good to stick with one, or can you switch?
Change.
Okay. And the other thing I wanted to ask is, like, if you didn't have a good relationship with your mother, but you have a deep longing for that, can you use that, or
yes.
Is it going to be more?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then, I'm just going to keep going, because I've been doing this meditation, and I think I'm experiencing, you know, what you're talking about, that heart-melting feeling and that kind of thing, but it has been intellectual for me, you know, to some degree as well, because I have to think these thoughts in order to get to that place still, and I'm kind of getting to a point now where my mind is wandering a little bit, and I'm not really sure, when you said, like, you get to a point where it isn't as intellectual anymore, it's just happening naturally in your heart, then what does your mind do then if you're not working to quiet it?
The mind is pulled into that.
Okay.
The intellect. The intellectual activity is quietened because your whole mind is engrossed in
okay.
that loving remembrance.
I feel like my mind is maybe just getting bored with it right now, and I'm not really sure what to do with that. Like, I just keep doing it anyway, but...
There's a couple other things that you can add in.
Okay.
Because the relationship is good, but what we really want is to be related to someone definite.
Uh-huh.
Just saying you're related to God is kind of vague. Mm-hmm. We like to be related to somebody beautiful, that we can see their eyes, their smile, they have two arms, they can hug us, right? We want to form.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's actually part of the meditation, that in this philosophy, God is described as having a form. And that doesn't limit God in every way. With that form, God is everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, God has more than one form, but is omnipresent in all of those forms.
Okay.
So, imagining a form that you're loving is also part of the meditation. Sometimes in the beginning that is too much for people because they're not used to thinking of God in that way.
Mm-hmm.
God is more of a general, vague thing to them. But actually to take the next step in this meditation, you need a form.
Okay.
You have to imagine a personal form that you love.
But not a person that I actually know? Or can be if I know somebody who's...
Yeah, if you... See, you can think of any form you want as long as you imbue divine qualities, meaning that you're not literally meditating on that person. You're taking their form because you like how they look, and in your mind you're thinking, this is God.
Okay.
That's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Then you're actually attaching your mind to God, not to that person.
Okay. That makes sense.
Because whatever is God's form, we can never exactly imagine it. Once we meet God face to face, we'll say, oh, that's what you look like. But until then, how can we imagine God's precise form? We can't. So any form is fine.
Okay. And that's, I guess, why it's beneficial to meet someone who is God-realized, because then you have that, and then you saw them in form.
Yeah, like, sure. You can use that as well.
Okay.
Yeah. And those God-realized saints have also described, because they have met God,
right,
saw, oh, that's what you look like. Then they described it in their writings that, you know, there are certain main forms of God, although God has unlimited forms, but there's like a divine love form and certain almighty forms. So the divine love form is the one that you can be the most free with in your relationship. You know, God also has a serious side. So, you know, if you're thinking of God as being supreme, almighty, ruler of the universe, there's a bit of fear there as well. But the divine, same God also has a loving side of his personality, you can say. And that divine love form of God is, you can meditate on and you can feel related to. And that form has been described by saints who have met God in that way. And the form is a very loving, you know, beautiful form, which is depicted in this painting right here. That painting was done based on the description of some of these saints. So we, in our on this path, people also use visual representations as a help in their meditation. It's not that, we're saying that picture is God. We're saying, use this image. Because saints say, you know, that's what God looks like. Of course, it's a material representation of a divine thing. So it's not exactly right. But take that, because it's a beautiful form. So you can meditate. And saints describe that the divine love form appears in two forms, actually. Female form and male form. So the names we've been chanting, Radhe Govinda, that's Radhe on the left, the female form of divine love, and Govinda or Krishna is the male form on the right. So that is, I would say, to get to the next level, eventually you have to start adding the form in. And you're not restricted to any particular form, but you can use the help of an image like this.
And you can switch?
Yes.
Yeah.
Eventually, you'll probably settle on a particular form that you like the most and a particular relationship that you like the most. That'll happen, probably, but you don't have to force it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes?
Just a small question. Just thinking of my daughter, who's had very terrible relationships with many people. If you go to a cat and say you have a great relationship with a cat, is that a good place to start?
I never thought about that. I mean, I would probably I would probably take the parts of that relationship, like the cat is, you know, you can trust the cat not to hurt you, yes, unconditional, you know, loving, all of, you can take those qualities and try to transfer that. I never thought about, I mean, I'm not sure how that would work as far
it's
as...
It's unusual.
Yeah. But those, I think she understands and would be looking for those same qualities in a human relationship. Mm-hmm. So she can transfer that to God as well. So now we added something more to the meditation. There's deeply thinking about your relationship with God. Then we added, you should feel that God is present here with you. That's really important. That you actually feel, if you're not a visual person, you should feel that God is present with you while you're meditating on your relationship. Then the third thing would be actually imagining a form, a loving, beautiful form that you want to love, that you want to even add the fourth thing. Now interact. In your meditation, now you have a form. Now you can, God can smile at you. You can smile at God. You can talk. You can hug, you can play a game, you can walk on the beach, you can do anything. So that interaction is called lila in the terms we use in Sanskrit. Lila means some kind of interaction between you and God. And then another thing you can add is like some kind of surroundings. You see, where are they sitting? You can think that's like the divine abode. You don't just have a form hanging in space, right? They're somewhere. In your meditation also, you can imagine that the beach you're walking on is a divine beach in the divine world, and you're walking with God, or you know, in a garden, or wherever you want to be. So that divine abode or divine atmosphere is also part of the meditation. And that's really all you need to know. You can add those things in to get greater depth to the meditation, but maybe in the beginning, just thinking of the relationship is enough. And then you get to a point where now, okay, now I want to add the form in, and then now I want to have some interaction. So that's all up to you. There's no restrictions or rules. Just whatever deepens your feeling of relationship with God. Any questions before we put it into practice?
Sure. Is it going to be related to this part or not? And I asked you last time, so how you can find your purpose in this life. Many people can find their purpose right away, and some people take time. And what's the reason that's blocking you that to get that to that purpose? Is it meditation?
Well, there's two purposes. There's your purpose of your soul, which is to find God. And that's universal for everybody, and that's your real purpose. And then there's what you do along the way until you find God, which is physically what do you have to do to make a living. So, you know, people have different senses of purpose, meaning someone may just do it as a job because they have to do something to make a living, but their main focus is spiritual. And then other people who are not as spiritually oriented, they find more, you know, emotional involvement in the things they do in the world. That depends on the person. But the ultimate purpose is to find God. That's the same for everybody.
That means by meditation, if you get closer, that you find God.
That's right.
More.
That's right.
Okay.
So let's do another chant. That's one, I forgot to add that part in actually. The chanting is an aid in meditation, just like the picture is. The chanting helps the mind become engrossed by, for one, blocking out external distractions, and for two, it actually brings the mind in. And because these names that we're chanting are actually substantially related to the divine love form of God and the divine love power, then the chanting does have a power. So your remembrance of God and of your relationship with God combines with the vibration of the chanting to develop the affinity in your heart more quickly than if you were to just do it in silence. You can do it in silence too, but the chanting actually can say it's like a catalyst. It speeds up the process and makes the meditation easier and gives you a deeper experience more quickly if you use the chanting along with it. So that's why we combine the two. The actual process that you're doing inside, your meditation, you think about that and just the chanting augments it or helps you to do it more easily. So let's close our eyes and you can put into practice what I was just explaining to you in whatever, at whatever stage you are, but start with the feeling of relationship and then from there move on to, feeling the divine presence of God and then moving to an actual visual.